Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Elkon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to yet another exciting show. Now, it's pretty funny to think back on what an utterly lazy student I was. I spent high school avoiding AP classes because I knew I could get into the University of Michigan with a bunch of easy A's and regular classes. The thing is, after school, I wasn't at the mall. I was reading like mad, but on subjects I was interested, not subjects I was forced to study. These days, I work harder than I ever did in school because I love science and I want to put out good science and funny writing, and that's just what it takes. But back when I was in school, I only wish I could have had the school experience of the son of my guest tonight, developmental psychologist Dr. Peter Gray. At his son's school, the Sudbury Valley School, there were no classes, no teachers, no grade levels, and no grades. And students seem to learn far better and turn out far better than they do in conventional schools. Tonight, on what should be a fascinating, controversial show, Dr. Gray will explain why our current educational system is actually counterproductive to educating kids, ignoring how children actually learn, and how important play is to that process. He'll also explain why schooling based on principles of a democracy applied to kids is highly effective schooling for keeping kids engaged, helping them develop self-control, and develop to their fullest and become highly productive adults living meaningful lives. We will be discussing his fascinating book, Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. Hello, Dr. Peter Gray.
Hi, Amy. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. I first heard you at the Northeast Evolutionary Psychology Conference talking about mixed-age play in kids, and I've been fascinated in your work ever since. And you have an interesting personal story that started you in this work. You had this upsetting exchange that you were a part of in the principal's office with your 9-year-old son. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I imagine there are other parents listening who have gone through at least somewhat similar experiences where you're called in time after time because your child is not doing what he or she is supposed to be doing in school. But this was a kind of special case. My son had been all through kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, and now into fourth grade. I don't know how we managed to keep him there that long, but we... his mother and I had been more or less fighting with him all that time to make him go to school. We believed school was important. He rebelled continuously during that time. He just didn't see the sense of it. He could learn outside of school. He was a kid who could read before he started school, read well. You know, not that we taught him, he just picked it up. And he would rebel in all sorts of ways in school. And it finally reached a crisis point in fourth grade. And the school just didn't know what to do with him. And so we had a meeting in the principal's office. There were his mother and I and a school psychologist and another psychologist who was brought in from the school district, the principal, his teacher, assistant teacher. We were all there confronting my little son, telling him in no uncertain terms, we all said our piece, in no uncertain terms, you have to follow the rules in school. There's, you know, we were going to give him this unified, you know, voice from all of these forces. And he heard us say our pieces, and then he just looked squarely at us, and he said, "Go to hell." And I began to cry.
Oh.
And that was the point that I realized, and his mother realized too. That was the turning point. We had to be on his side. He was right. We just had to admit it. At least for him, he was right. This was not a good environment for him. He knew it from the beginning. He was not going to submit to what to him seemed like prison-like conditions that he did not deserve to be put in. So that was the story, and that was, the, in a way, the beginning of a new phase in my research career.
And now I just wanted to say one thing I was impressed by was both your son and you and your wife showed these critical thinking skills, because in America, this is how school is. You go, it's like jail, and you must learn and you must do all these things the way they say. And your son said, no, you know, this is crap. And you and your wife thought, well, maybe it is crap, you know, perhaps driven by emotion. And that's a remarkable thing. And this did change the course of your career. You started conducting research on how children learn through play. And that actually started with you sending him to a school that is unlike most schools, the Sudbury Valley School, which we'll talk about. That's the thing I talked about, there are no grades. How did you have the guts to send him to this school? And tell us a little bit about the school.
Yes, well, we knew from our son that it wasn't going to work to find just another school, a standard school, even one that's sort of a progressive school that would give him a little more freedom. He wasn't going to stand for any of that. It was pretty clear. You know, he needed to be in charge of his own education, and I've now come to the conclusion that all kids really need to be in charge of their own education. They're not all able to articulate it and fight for it the way he was. Somehow he had an understanding of that, even though he was a young child. And most children had a gut-level feel-up, but they don't have the same understanding that leads them to rebel in quite the same way. They may rebel in other ways. But at any rate, it led us to find a school called, the school is called the Sudbury Valley School, which now, today, has been in existence for 45 years. It had already been in existence for a good number of years, something like 12 years at that time. And this is as different from our standard conception of a school as you can imagine. It's a school at which there's no curriculum, there are no tests, there's no division of children by age into grades. There's no evaluation of children in any kind of formal way. I mean, if a child asks for feedback on something, of course, whoever he asks it of will give it, just as if you or I were to ask feedback on each other's writing, we would give it freely. But, you know, we're not going to sit the other person down and make them do this or that. And that's the way the school operates. The school today has about 140 students and something like 10 staff members. The students range in age from 4 on through high school age, but there's no distinction between who's a high school student and who's a middle school student or a grade school student. They're just all there. And there's a lot of things to do, a lot of very interesting things to do, and a lot of very interesting people. And the students get engaged in whatever interests them, and interests vary. They go from one thing to another. They all learn to read. Most of them don't seem to need any particular help in learning to read, but if somebody wants help in learning to read, there are staff members who will help them. Sometimes kids will ask older kids for a little help in learning to read. But most of it occurs quite naturally in the course of their play. This is a school, you know, when you don't make people read, reading is fun. And so all the kids read, I mean, some more than others, obviously, but they read the current books, whatever the fads are. They read a lot on their own and whatever interests them.
I think you're talking about Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, they certainly have read all the Harry Potter books and then all the Twilight Zone books, depending on who the kids are. Not the Twilight Zone, the Twilight series books. And the little kids see bigger kids reading and talking about books, and they want to read. So at any rate, that's the way the school works in terms of education. Education is seen as the responsibility of children themselves, and the children, for the most part, carry out that responsibility by playing and exploring and getting interested in things and in the process learning.
Now, it sounds like when you're talking about those fun books they're reading, it sounds like these kids go through school like it's sort of like just fun, and that they're maybe not learning the stuff that they need to get into college and to do well. But it turns out that actually from your survey that you did, that they are extremely prepared, extremely self-directed, extremely responsible. They have skills and knowledge. And interestingly, they lack fear of authority figures because of the way they have a relationship with the adults at Sudbury Valley, and the way everybody's an equal there, and it's a democratic process where everybody gets a vote. It's not like the teacher gets to slam you with a ruler like happened to my boyfriend with the nuns.
Yes, exactly. And the school is, this is the another remarkable thing about the school. It's run democratically by the school meeting, at which every student, no matter the student's age, and every staff member has one vote. And as I said, there are about 140 students and 10 staff members. So if it were ever staff versus students, which it never is, of course the students would win on that vote. So this is a school that is quite literally run by the students and the staff together. Not only are all the school rules made in this way, but the staff are hired and fired by the school meeting. So if there's no staff member who has more than a one-year contract, and every year every staff member has to be voted back into staff. And any staff member who doesn't get at least a majority of the vote of the students at the school will not be a staff member the next year. There's more to it than that. There also has to be some discussion of what the needs are and how many staff are needed. But the first step is a majority vote by all of the school meeting in order to renew a contract. So this is really quite remarkable. A school in which the students themselves actually are in charge of hiring and firing the teachers, although they don't call themselves teachers at the school, they call themselves staff members, because there's a recognition that students are teachers too, and everybody's learning from one another in this kind of a setting. The staff are really just the adult members of the school community.
Well, we're going to get into why that works, why this self-directed learning works, but I have to do a station ID. And then after that, before we get into why it works, I want to talk about Daniel Greenberg, who started Sudbury Valley on the principles of democracy, applying them to education, which I just love. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is developmental psychologist, and his book is Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. So let's talk about Daniel Greenberg. He was a professor, and he had some ideas about how to educate people and began this school.
Yes, Daniel Greenberg was a professor of physics initially, and then of history of science. He was actually one of the originators of the field of history of science back in the early 1960s, late 1950s, early 1960s. And he was teaching at Columbia University, and he noticed, like many young professors, that the students seemed to enjoy his class in a certain sense, and that they liked to be amused, and they found him interesting, but that they did very little work on their own for the class unless it was required of them. And even then, they seemed to just do the minimum that they had to do in order to get whatever grade they wanted. So, you know, here's a funny situation. You're paying a lot of money to go to college. Not as much money in those days as today, but the same thing applies today. You're paying a lot of money to go to college, and in some sense you're trying to get the least out of it that you can while getting the highest grade. You know, it's a strange situation. So he began to wonder you know, why? What's wrong with our educational system? Why are these people even taking these courses if they're not really interested in it? They seem to be doing it just because I'm sort of making them do it. They need it to get the grade and so on. What's wrong with our educational system? And it led him to really spend a lot of time thinking about education and looking into what school entails. And among other things, Greenberg is a strong believer in the basic principles of American democracy, freedom to pursue your own route to happiness, individual control of their own lives, voting on rules that affect you. And he began to think that if people are going to develop their own interests and pursue their own routes to happiness, they have to have that opportunity as children. They have to grow up with the feeling that this is expected of them and that they're allowed to do this.
Noticed, you know, in your writing about Greenberg, and I should say I left your name off when I did my little station ID. I'm talking with Dr. Peter Gray, who authored Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life, that Greenberg called the educational system in our country the most un-American institution we have, and how unindividualistic it is, how we aren't able to choose what we study, and I just wanted to read, you quote some of his ideas in this book he wrote with some other reformers. They pointed out that democracy rests on three root ideas, that human beings have certain fundamental rights, that people affected by a decision should have a voice in making the decision, and that all people should have equal opportunities to succeed in life. And what's so amazing is that he brought those ideas, those were the guiding principles of his school, you know, that where he felt that schooling should help prepare people to be citizens of a democracy, and you don't do that effectively by depriving students of those opportunities and responsibilities when they're growing up.
That's right. He felt you needed to trust children to be responsible, otherwise they don't grow up to be responsible. So here they are in this small-scale democratic community learning how to be democratic citizens and also learning how to take control of their own lives and figuring out what they want to do and figuring out what they've got to learn in order to do what they want to do. You know, this sounds, Amy, this, most people when they hear this, it just sounds unreal. It doesn't sound like, you know, it sounds like this is a dream, you know. Doesn't sound like this is something that could really work. I mean, and people try to dismiss it in various ways. So, for example, maybe these are just really special kids to begin with, or maybe they're being taught at home, and so on and so forth. And I've looked at all of that. I mean, these are kids coming from, they're very normal kids coming from a wide variety of backgrounds. Some of them were failures in public school, and then they did well here. Some of them did well in public school, and then they continued to do well at this school. Some of them just came because their parents believed in it. It's not an elite school. It's very inexpensive compared to any other private schools in the area. It doesn't draw from the private school crowd. If the kids have been to any other school before, it's been a public school. You know, this is not something that's easily dismissed. And I might say, I neglected to mention this before when you were alluding to the fact that the students do go on to do well in life, that my first study of the school was a study of the graduates. I was quite, as you can well understand, I was concerned when my son started there, would he be cutting his options in any way? Would he be able to go to college from such a different kind of school if he wanted to? Are there any career options that are going to be cut off because of this unusual route to education? So I did a study of the graduates, and at that time there were already a good number of graduates, something like 80 graduates, and I managed to identify I managed to get about 90% of them, find them, get them into a survey, which I then published the results in the American Journal of Education. And amazingly, they didn't seem to have any difficulty going on to college if that's what they wanted. They'd gone in all walks of life. There wasn't a single student, not a single one, that I identified who, when I asked, do you regret having gone to such an unusual school? There wasn't a single one who regretted it. They were all happy that they had gone there. They all felt that they were succeeding in life better because of that school than they would have if they had continued in a standard school.
I love how you say that, you know, you note that these students, they felt well prepared for college, because that was sort of my worry when I first heard you talk. I kept thinking the same thing. Do they really know math? But it turns out one of the guys who studied, Fred, became a math professor. And I love examples which show the freedom the school gives kids and the responsibility they trust them with. You talked about Carol, the cruise ship captain, who spent a lot of time, she just leaves school, go to this nearby seacoast area to take advantage of the school's open campus policy, you know, and to go study what she really was interested in. I just think that that is so great. I could have been trusted to do that, but of course, and in fact, actually, I did escape from school. I worked out my own escape, if I think about it now. I got an internship during high school at a TV station, and I was supposed to be gone, I think it was like Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and be in school Tuesday and Thursday, but I just pretended I was supposed to be gone all those days and just skip class and read or did something. And so, you know, it wasn't that I was at the mall. Again, it was just school was boring and easy. So, and it was like jail. And you point out actually earlier in the book, and I want to get to this stuff here, about why it's okay, why this is the right way. And you say that children are biologically predisposed. We evolved this way to take charge of our own education. And that when kids are provided with the freedom and the means to pursue their own interests, they bloom, they develop, they acquire skills much better than when they're in some kind of school as jail.
Yes. Well, you know, of course, after doing that study of the graduates, I became interested in how do they learn? What are they doing? And if you just walk into the school grounds at any given time of day, you'd say, well, they're just playing. You know, they're playing, they're exploring, they're talking with one another. They may be reading, but it looks like pleasure reading. And somehow out of all of that, they're becoming educated. But when you look closer at what they're doing, you realize the high level of mental activity as well as physical activity that's occurring during play. Children are continuously, and adolescents too, challenging themselves in their play and challenging their own and each other's mental abilities and rising to higher and higher levels. The age mixing is a key.
Oh wait, we're going to get to that, but I just want to go into something you said about Hillary Clinton, because it's a great example of this. She was talking, you quoted her talking about a game called Chase and Run, which she called a kind of complex team-based hide-and-seek tag combination. And she said the roles were elaborate and they were hammered out in long consultations on street corners. It was how we spent countless hours. And you say, regardless of which side of the political fence you're on, that you can agree that Hillary grew up to be an extraordinarily competent, confident, and socially adept adult, and you can think of her hammering out agreements among world leaders, you know, and think of her as a little girl doing the same, you know, with the rules for chase and run. And so play actually teaches people a lot. And you write about that from the hunter-gatherer perspective, how this is how we evolved, that play is a form of learning how to manage our world.
That's exactly right. You know, play really came about evolutionarily as the way that children learn how to take control of their own behavior, learn how to control their emotions, learn how to get along with other people, learn how to negotiate with other people. You know, one of the key features of play is that it's completely voluntary. Anybody can quit. So if you want to continue playing, if you and I are children playmates, and I want the game to go, I've got to figure out in some sense who you are, and I've got to please you. I've got to satisfy you. I can't bully you. I can't make all the rules. I've got to listen to you. We've got to negotiate our differences. Otherwise, the game ends. But neither of us wants the game to end. So that is extraordinarily powerful, motivating force for us to learn to see from each other's perspectives, for us to learn how to get what we want in the interaction, what I want in the interaction, while at the same time allowing you to get what you want in the interaction. Well, what could be a more important skill than that for all of social life? And children are constantly practicing that in play, as well as practicing all sorts of skills that are important, because children in whatever culture they're growing up in tend to play at those kinds of skills that are important to the culture. No surprise that kids today play with computers, you know. This is the tool of our culture, just as hunter-gatherer kids played with bows and arrows and dugout canoes and knives and blow darts, the tools of their culture. Children in our culture play with those tools. They instinctively know that they've got to play with these, with what they see to be the tools of the culture in order to become effective adults.
Now, you say one of the most insidious ways that school has taken over children's lives is by fostering an attitude that children learn and progress primarily by doing these tasks that are directed and evaluated by adults, and that children's own activities are a waste of time. They cut recess and everything. But you talk about, in contrast, what life was like for hunter-gatherer children, or these few remaining hunter-gatherer tribes, or that what were remaining hunter-gatherer tribes, and give these amazing examples of the autonomy they give their children. I want to just read a couple of them. You say that hunter-gatherers do not give orders to their children. No adult announces bedtime. I love this. At night, children remain around adults until they feel tired and fall asleep. And that Paracana adults in Brazil don't interfere with their children's lives. They don't beat or scold or behave aggressively to them. They don't offer praise. They don't keep track of their development. And one more, Hudson Bay Inuit infants and young children are allowed to explore their environments. The kid, if he picks up a machete, the parents will leave it to explore the dangers on its own. And you think that bad things would happen, but and also that the kids would be, you know, these sort of entitled brats. But you say that the truth is quite the contrary, that they become these sort of self-directed, responsible, very successful adults.
Yes, that's right, Amy. I got really interested in hunter-gatherer cultures as an evolutionary psychologist because, of course, you know, genetically we are all hunter-gatherers. We've had agriculture and industry only for a very tiny portion of our evolutionary history. So we evolved to adapt to largely to a hunter-gatherer style of life. So I became interested. Well, what is life like for children in hunter-gatherer cultures? And so I began by reading whatever I could and then did a survey of anthropologists who had lived in hunter-gatherer cultures, some in Africa, some in Asia, some in South America, some in Australia, New Guinea, various parts of the world. And what's quite remarkable is no matter where these cultures have been found and studied, they are quite similar to one another in their attitudes about children. They believe that they trust children's instincts. They believe that children need essentially infinite time to play and explore, that this is how children learn. They don't tell children what to do. They believe that children need to direct their own lives, and that children learn to direct their own lives by being allowed to. Hunter-gatherers have a very extraordinarily egalitarian approach. There's no hunter-gatherers, unlike the later tribal societies that were partly agricultural. Hunter-gatherers live in small bands. They have no chief, no big man. They make their decisions by consensus. And they share everything. And so in order to do this, people need to grow up not to be subservient, because there's no leader to follow. They need to grow up knowing how to exert their own will, how to be creative, because hunting and gathering are extraordinarily creative activities. And they also, these cultures, have rich music and various forms of art. So these are cultures in which creativity is valued, will is valued, but there's at the same time they need to get along with one another. And as I just explained, these are the things you learn in play. you learn to be creative. You learn the skills of your culture, and you learn how to get along with one another in play. So, quite
rightly.
I
wanted to get into that a little more in depth. I'm just conscious that I have so much to get through with you. I didn't mean
sure.
to interrupt you, but I want to do a station ID, and I want you just to tell us some of the things that children get out of play. But first, a station ID, and I'm going to remember your name this time to say that this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life for the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is developmental psychologist Dr. Peter Gray, and his book is Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. So tell us, because I want people to know, what are some of the things that children get out of play? We talked about Hillary Clinton learning these negotiating skills. What? Tell us about that and about some others.
All right. Well, you know, developmental psychologists kind of sometimes divide development up into social development, emotional development, intellectual development, physical skill development. All of these are learned in play. So I've talked about social development. In play, social play, you have to learn to see things from another person's perspective. You have to be able to empathize. You have to be able to negotiate. So social skills are clearly developed in social play. Emotional development. Now, here's something interesting. Animal behaviorists who study play in animals have developed what they call the emotion regulation theory of play, that what they've found is that when they deprive young mammals, and this is usually done with either monkeys or rats, when you deprive a young monkey or young rat with the opportunity to play with playmates, and there are ways of raising them so they have other social experiences but they don't have play, then as they mature into adulthood and you test them in various ways, they are unable to regulate their emotions. They overreact with fear when you put them in a fearful situation. They overreact with anger and aggression when you put them in a situation that elicits frustration, or in which they're paired with another animal and they will lash out aggressively to that animal even if the other one is making friendly overtures towards it. They haven't learned how to control their emotions. So one thing that young animals are doing continuously in their play is they are exercising emotional control. They're playing in ways that are somewhat dangerous, that elicit fear. You can imagine monkeys swinging high up in branches, and just as you can imagine young children climbing trees high enough to make their parents nervous. And you can imagine, you know, Just as young animals do this, young human beings do the same thing. Their dangerous play is a way of exercising your own capacity to experience fear and know that you can tolerate that and get over it. So when young mammals, and I would argue young humans, are not allowed to play in these ways, they don't learn how to control their emotions in such so well. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why we're seeing such a high rate of anxiety disorders today and various other emotional disorders among children today, as we are now in an environment in which we are depriving children of play much more than we did even a few decades ago. It's quite remarkable, anthropologists have pointed out, the enormous emotional control that hunter-gatherer children have. They don't whine, they don't, you know, I mean, I've never lived in a hunter-gatherer culture, but I've heard this from many different anthropologists who are studying different cultures, so there must be something to it. They are remarkably cheerful. They can suffer pain, they can suffer all kinds of diseases, and they act cheerful right through it. They have learned how to control their negative feelings and emotions to an extraordinary extent. And I think it's no coincidence that the very same people who are allowed to play the most, the very same culture of people who are allowed to play the most, are also the culture of people who seem to have the most ability to control their own emotions and maintain a cheerful attitude even in what would look to be very distressing circumstances.
I like something you say in the book. You say that perhaps play would be more respected if we called it something like self-motivated practice of life skills, which it actually is, although that would make it be a lot less fun if you identified it as that. But it really, they're just, you lay out in your book, Free to Learn, and I'm talking with Dr. Peter Gray, developmental psychologist and author of Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. One of the examples you give about how great play is that a playful state of mind enables children to solve logic problems. There's so many ways that it enhances their ability to be successful adults, and yet we sit kids in these sort of jails and where you say curiosity, playfulness, and meaningful conversation, they're all thwarted because they require freedom. And our school system is about taking away kids' freedom and not allowing them any curiosity relevant to anything other than finishing the task at hand. And it's just incredible that this happens.
Yeah, well, I think the way to explain it is historically. Why do we have schools that operate this way? I mean, psychologists know, I mean, this is well established, that the continuous testing and monitoring and judgment inhibits new learning, inhibits creativity. There are many, many experiments along this line that if people go into learning a new task with a playful attitude, not a situation in which they're being judged, where they're just allowed to play with this, they do much better at solving new problems, figuring out new ways to do things, learning new things, than they do when somebody is looking over their shoulder and assessing what they do. When everything that they do is being judged, their concern becomes with, how do I please the judge? It puts you in a kind of emergency state of mind. You're motivated more by fear if you care about getting the high grade, or you're motivated by getting that high grade, and you're thinking, what do I have to do to please this person? You're not immersing yourself into that problem for its own sake and really burying yourself in that problem and trying out new ways of doing it.
You just reminded me of something you remarked on, these studies. I just wanted to bring this up now in case you weren't about to do that.
Sure.
These studies where you talked about kids were told, okay, do a creative project. They were given a creative assignment, and half the kids were told, okay, you're going to get something, a gold star, you'll be evaluated afterward. And the other kids were told, just do something, have fun, draw something. And those kids' drawings, they evaluate them in these ways, that they were evaluated as much more creative than the kids were told that there was an outcome, a grade, somebody watching.
Yes, exactly. That's right. There have been many studies done this way, with adults as well as kids, by the way, that when you are... when you believe you are doing something to be judged, you become overly conscious of that judgment and inhibits your ability to get really into the problem. You know who does well when they're being judged is people who already are highly skilled at it. So there have been studies in which you compare, for example, people who are highly skilled at playing billiards, let's say, that's one example that actually has been studied, versus people who are new to the game. The people who are highly skilled actually do better when they're judged, because the judgment leads them to put everything into it, and they've already got the moves down. And when you're in that state of mind, that's a good state for doing what you already know how to do, what's already second nature to you. But for something that's new, for something that involves creativity, that's the worst state of mind to be in. There, you want to be in a mind where you're not afraid of failure, because you're trying something new, and you have to be free to try it and to feel like it's okay if you fail. But we put kids into situations where failure is a bad word. You know, failure is that big F. And that fear of failure, that feeling like I can't make a mistake here, that's exactly the opposite to the feeling that you need in order to be creative or to learn something new. Because learning something new always is, in some sense, an act of creation. You have to allow yourself to play with this idea, to really engage that idea into your mind, to really incorporate that idea in a meaningful way into your mental structure. So So by making school work rather than play, by making it into something where students are constantly being judged and evaluated, and the judgment and evaluation is really the motivation for them to do it rather than the interest of the material itself, that is a recipe for kind of shallow learning that, in fact, is what we see in school, where kids will learn what they need to learn to pass the test, but then very quickly forget it later on.
Now, I want to get into something fascinating you talk about in the book. You show how kids are excellent teachers of other kids, and I love the example you give. You write about Sugata Mitra. I hope I'm saying that right. He's the science director of an educational tech firm in India. He did this experiment, went to a slum, turned a computer on, and told the children they could play with it. And an amazing thing happened. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, he did this first just with one computer in one of the worst slums in New Delhi. It happened to be kind of right at the back door of where his firm, educational technology firm, was located. He just put, he called it a hole-in-the-wall experiment because he opened a hole in the brick wall of the building, put up a computer there, and told the kids on the street, these are street kids, unschooled kids, largely illiterate, that they could play with it if they wished. Didn't tell them anything more about it. This was a number of years ago. None of them had ever seen a computer before. They thought it looked like some kind of a television set, but they couldn't. So they went up and played with it, and really, literally within hours, they were making discoveries on it, how to turn it on and off, how to make things happen on it. They were soon learning how to use the draw and paint applications on the computer. Later on, he set up a computer that had internet access. And
I just want to stop you because I wanted to just add something that you wrote.
Sure.
And it's really important that these kids discovered how to use it with no help but each other's. And I think that's really important.
Well, that's right. What would happen is that they would gather in groups, and so one person would make a discovery and share it with everybody else. And moreover, they would be so excited about these discoveries that then they would go and bring other people up to the computer. And so what Mitra eventually found, he actually ended up establishing a number of these computer kiosks throughout various places of in India, and later on in some other countries as well. And what he found is for every computer that he set up, an average of 300 kids, if you can believe that, became computer literate. One computer, 300 kids become computer literate. And once they become computer literate, you know, Amy, the whole world of knowledge is available to them. You know, he saw kids learning English who didn't know English because there were a lot of English words on the computer, and they began to learn it from each other. Kids who couldn't read were learning to read from the kids who could read, who were helping them read the words. Amazing thing. He called this education with minimal intervention, you know, similar to surgery with minimal intervention. It's allowing, providing the smallest intervention, just this computer in there, and suddenly education is occurring.
Now, this leads us perfectly, we have a few questions, but leads us perfectly to something that I heard you speak on a few years ago on age-mixed play. We do have a few questions, and Dan's question about the detrimental effects of not having enough play, I think we'll cover that. We have a few others. I'm going to try to get to all of them. Tell us, what is age-mixed play?
Well, age-mixed play is really play among children who differ in age. And I'm not talking just about children who are just 1 or 2 years difference, but what you see in hunter-gatherer cultures, what you see at the Sudbury Valley School, what you see among these street kids in India who are playing at the computer, is age-mixing across a wide range of ages. You know, similarly to when I was a kid, the neighborhood play, there was a wide range of ages all playing together. And the quality of that kind of play is quite different than when everybody's the same age. It's much more nurturant. The the younger kids are learning from the older kids. The older kids are learning to sort of be caring and how to teach when they're interacting with the younger kids, not because they think of themselves as teachers, but you just kind of naturally have to teach in order to keep the game going. So there's one of the points I make when I talk about play generally is that our play instinct evolved in a world in which play was always age mixed. You know, hunter-gatherers don't even have enough, there's not even enough kids in the hunter-gatherer band to segregate by age and just play with kids the same age, even if you wanted to. So play evolved its educative characteristics in a setting where it's always age mixed.
Now, and I want you to, can I just ask you, because we don't have too much time, I have so much to get to, because uh-huh. your book is so fascinating, your ideas are fascinating. You gave this great example when I heard you speak at the Evolutionary Psychology Conference about a 3-year-old, I think it was, and a 9-year-old playing ball. And talk about how that affects each of those kids, how it helps each learn different things.
Well, this is kind of a metaphor for what I see all the time, but imagine a playground in which everybody's 4 years old. In this playground, there's no such thing as catch, because 4-year-olds cannot play catch with one another. You know, no 4-year-old can throw the ball straight enough for the other 4-year-old to catch it, and no 4-year-old can leap and run well enough to catch the wild throw of a 4-year-old. But now imagine a playground that has not just 4-year-olds, but also some 8-year-olds. And the 8-year-olds are bigger, they're more agile, they've been playing catch, they know how to do it. Now, 4-year-olds, as well as 8-year-olds, can play catch, because a 4-year-old can throw the ball to an 8-year-old. The 8-year-old can leap and jump and catch the wild throw of the 4-year-old. And the 8-year-old can also very gently toss the ball into the outreaching hands of the 4-year-old so that the 4-year-old can sometimes catch it. So now both the 4-year-old and the 8-year-old can play a game of catch, and both can enjoy it. The 4-year-old is just thrilled to actually catch a ball. I'm really playing catch, and I'm doing it with this cool older kid, you know. And the 8-year-old is also enjoying it. I can leap and jump and catch this ball that the 4-year-old is throwing, and I can toss it so well that the 4-year-old is catching it. And moreover, I am the mature one in this relationship. I am helping this 4-year-old. So here we have a situation, and think of all the learning that's going on in that situation. Not only catch, but learning, the 8-year-old is learning a sense of his own maturity, a sense of how to be caring to a 4-year-old. So this is an example of, I've actually seen this kind of thing happen, but it is really a metaphor for what happens all the time in age-mixed play. There's this kind of scaffolding in which the older child boosts the younger one up into a higher realm of activity so that the younger one can now do things that he or she couldn't do if that person were just interacting with age mates.
I just love that. I see that with my neighbors, the kids. One kid is, I think, 4 years older than the other, and he's so kind to his younger sister, and
yeah.
You see that learning experience. I should do a station ID. I'm going to get to Dan's question by asking you another question. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is developmental psychologist Dr. Peter Gray, and his book is Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. So Dan's question is about the detrimental effects of not having enough play, and I think we can answer that with something you wrote about anthropologist David Lancey, who talks about that he thinks our schools may be teaching children not to learn by observation, by indoctrinating students the idea that learning occurs through this top-down verbal instruction from a teacher. And he talked about seeing a kid skiing in Utah who came upon this unusual kind of ski lift, and you said that, you know, that Lancey said any kid in a culture, like a hunter-gatherer type culture, would have observed and seen what was, you know, the way to do things, where this kid stopped everybody and asked about it instead of observing.
Yeah, that's a kind of example. And there is some documented systematic evidence that the more schooled the child is, the less observant the child is in terms of just looking around and seeing and learning things on his own. Children seem to become dependent on or believe that they learn only by adults explaining things to them. But, you know, back to the question that you said Dan raised of the harm of play deprivation, there's a more serious problem even than that. And that's that over the past, and this is very well documented, over the past 50 or 60 years in the United States, there's been a continuous decline in children's freedom to play. I mean, when I was a kid in the 1950s, just like Hillary Clinton when she was a kid, we had enormous amounts of time to play outdoors, away from adults. We were trusted. And so we had, in some sense, the hunter-gatherer education as well as school. School was not the big deal that it is today. And when we were out playing, we were playing by ourselves. We weren't directed by adults. We weren't in adult-directed sports. Such sports did exist, but they were a very minor portion of the activities of kids. Now, over this past the 50 or 60 years that there's been this continuous and over time dramatic decline in children's freedom to play and explore on their own, there has been a dramatic and very serious increase in all sorts of childhood psychopathology, increase in anxiety disorder, increase in major depression among children, increase in suicides, you know, something like four times as the suicide rate among children under age 15 is now about four times what it was in the 1950s. Using unchanged measures, there are certain, as you may know, certain psychological tests like the MMPI and Taylor's Manifest Anxiety Scale, which have been given to normative samples of children and adolescents and young adults over many, many decades. Using those measures from those tests, the incidence of major depressive disorder and of anxiety disorders are 5 to 8 times today what they were just 50 or 60 years ago. And over time, it's been an almost linear increase that in some sense runs just perpendicular to the decrease in free play that's occurred over that time. Now,
and
I make the
just,
case
I just wanted
the,
to say speculatively, because
sure.
We have so much to get to, that this could be due to the loss of control that you have as a kid who, you know, you described how you left school and you went sledding, you know, and we did this. We were told to go to the park, and we weren't even told. We went to the park. We came
of
home
course.
At dark because that's when dinner was served, and nobody worried about us or thought we were kidnapped. Now,
right.
We have a lot of stuff to get to, and I want to try to get to people's questions. One of the questions that we have is from Michael, who's a student teacher calling from Sydney, Australia. And sorry for asking your question, Michael, just for time purposes. He wants to know what he can do to apply some of this to teaching his kid without a special school.
Well, I think the main thing that you can do is figure out ways for your child to play, really play, with other kids in age-mixed groups, independently of adults, and allow as much time as you can for that. Kids really need time for play. And it's not always so easy today to do that, but there are ways to figure out how to do it. The first step is to realize that this is really important. Kids need it. And then the second step is to figure out how, in our world today, to allow kids to have this play that they need.
Well, you talk about in your own life trustful parenting, and I love Lenore Skenazy, who started the Free Range Kids movement. She's a friend of mine. She was called the worst mother in the world for letting her son Izzy, who is 9, ride the New York City subway. And you actually top Lenore. You let your 13-year-old son go to London at age 13, not because you were bad parents, but because you felt he was responsible enough.
Yeah, and you know he earned all the money for this, believe it or not. You know, I mean he earned the money by working in a restaurant first as a washing dishes and then as a cook. Now nowadays, this was back in the 1980s. Nowadays, he wouldn't be allowed legally to have such a job. He'd have to be 16 in the state of Massachusetts to have such a job. But at the age of 12, he had that job and earned the money for this trip. He figured out the entire trip himself. This was before computers. He couldn't just go online. He figured out where he was going to go. He had this all figured out before he presented his mother and me with the plan. Well, what could we say? He'd figured it out. He had shown himself to be so mature that he'd earned the money for it. He planned this thing. You know, now, I think some of your listeners are going to really think I'm a terrible parent when I add this to the mix. He had, and of course still has, type 1 diabetes. That was our big concern, you know. And so I have some qualms about anybody at any age traveling alone with type 1 diabetes. But he convinced us that he knew how to take care of his diabetes. He would wear his medical alert. We knew that he had been taking as good care of his own diabetes as any adult that we knew. We never gave him insulin. He took his own insulin. He controlled his own diet. We didn't tell him what he had to eat and couldn't eat. Because he was raised in a way that he was allowed to take control, he knew how to control himself. And so in the end, he, just like he won the argument that got him out of school, he won this argument too, much to his credit. And you know, I'm so glad that we allowed him to do that. It was a tremendous growing experience for him to do this. Now, I don't know that every 13-year-old is ready to do this, but you have to know your kid. And my 13-year-old at that time, in fact, he was really just 12 when the whole thing was planned. He turned 13 just as he left. He was clearly mature enough to do this.
I think it's great that you did that. And that's what Nora says, too. You have to know your kid. Now,
right.
I want to just get to John's question. Very interesting question. He's a teen father. He wants to know how to discipline his kid. What is your thinking on that?
Well, discipline is, you know, that's a very general term, and I would have to know more of the specific situation. But I think it's always, you know, I think sometimes we are overly concerned about discipline. We think about discipline rather than thinking about trying to figure out with our kids what ought to be the rules. You know, what are sensible rules, allowing kids to have some say in what those rules are. And maybe even oftentimes parents find that if they allow the kids to enter into it. So what is the issue? Is the issue that the child is not cleaning up his bedroom? Let's say that's the problem. And the child is making a big mess in the house, not cleaning things up. So you sit down and talk this over with the child and you ask the child, well, what do you think it's all right for you to do this and that your mom and I should have to pick all this stuff up? And it's the rare child who will say, oh, yeah, that's all right. You know, most children will say, oh, no, that's really not fair of me. And then you sit down and you think, well, so what do you think there ought to be any kind of consequences if you don't do it? So in other words, to really kind of bring the child, trust the child to reason with you about this and not just make it an order and you have to do it because I say so, but to bring the child in as a partner in talking about it. Now, I don't know if this always works, and it may vary somewhat with the child and somewhat with the issue, but I think it works a lot more than we believe it would, and that it's certainly worth a shot.
That seems like such great advice. This brings me to, I just wanted to read a few of your points because we're so short on time. Your advice for people who want to become more trustful parents, and you say they should examine their own values, let go of the idea that you determine your child's future, and let go of that psycho feeling behind that. That was me adding that. Resist the temptation to monitor your child's activities, and create places and opportunities for your children to explore, find or create places and opportunities for your children to explore, and consider alternatives to conventional schooling. And, you know, like the Sudbury School, which is based on principles from democracy, which that people should have a voice in making a decision, even children, which is just so important. So I think that those are fantastic. And I just wanted to ask you, I'm so sorry we're out of time because I could talk to you for 2 hours.
Sure.
If you have just a parting words to leave people on You know, just some parting words of advice.
Well, I think that the I think that maybe my parting word is this. You know, children are first and foremost human beings. Children are not as different from us adults as we often make them out to be. They want freedom just as you and I want freedom. They want privacy just as you and I want privacy. They have better judgment than we generally think they have. One way to realize that is think about yourself when you were your child's age. Think about the things that you thought about. And I bet you will realize that you thought about things pretty deeply, that you had a pretty good sense of what's right and wrong, that you had a lot of judgment. And if you recognize that you had that as a child, because you can remember it, then you may be able to see it better in the children that you're responsible for today, whether they're your own children at home or whether they're children that you are responsible for in a school setting or a playground or in other situations.
Thank you. Wow, this has been such a great show. I'm so sorry we're out of time. This is Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in therapy and research. Thank you, Peter, my guest tonight, developmental psychologist Dr. Peter Gray, and his book, Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life.